Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing on Euston Road, NW1. One street west of the Camden Ripper's pickup place. Two roads south of Paula Field's dismembered body parts. One street north of the sad-faced killer's last sleep. And a short walk from the despicable deadbeat who drilled. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Situated at 137 to 139 Euston Road in King's Cross, currently stands the Travel Lodge. Like most chain hotels, the complimentary coffee in the rooms will undoubtedly be bad. It always is. Being cheapo crap, which tastes like it's been scraped off a baboon's backside. With a single serving of milk so mean, I'd be better off suckling on a mouse's teat. And with just two biscuits, yes, two, either they don't want me to have a nice time, or they don't think I'm a man, but a chihuahua on hunger strike. Thankfully, back in 1945, on the ground floor stood an all-night coffee stall which was owned by Fred White. A place where during the wartime blackout, servicemen and civilians could chow down on sandwiches with cups of hot coffee and tea. It was cheap, friendly, and safe. Or at least it should have been. On Monday the 15th of January 1945, at 12:15 a.m, a Dutch seaman called Jan Perveen was murdered at Fred White's coffee stall. It was a brutal and unprovoked attack which came out of nowhere. And yet it was both expected and unexpected, as the killer was already known to the police as the Creeper. My name is Michael. I am your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 247. The Creeper. Most people are murdered by those they already know. Stranger attacks are rare. Killings without motive are even rarer. And although it does happen, it doesn't happen like this. Sunday the 14th of January 1945, King's Cross. After the D-Day landings, as the Allies swept across Europe, the German war machine spluttered to a halt, and bombing raids were few and far between. Like most cities, London was no longer in a full blackout, but a dim out, meaning that, unless an air raid sounded, lighting was permitted to the equivalent of moonlight. The night was dark, cold, and cloudy, as a sprinkling of frost peppered the pavements. At the Osborne Hotel on Ensley Street, two Dutch merchant seamen on shore leave met for the very first time and headed out to grab a bite to eat and sink a few pints. They were Gerrit Bravenboer, a short but stocky sailor in his mid-20s, and 27-year-old Jan Bernardus Pervien of Rotterdam. A 6'2" hulk with a barrel chest, ham hock legs, no neck, no charm, no patience, and very little brains, whose tree trunk thick arms were crudely doodled with enough rude tattoos to make a docker blush. Normally, I would tell you about his life story, about the pain, misery, and heartbreak of his upbringing, so that you can sympathize with his plight and perhaps cry when his life is cruelly ended. But I won't. Jan was a violent drunken brute, a racist thug, and a bigoted moron, who picked fights with no reason, who wasn't liked, as you will see, and whose actions that night speak for themselves. And although in theory he was the victim, he had more to do with his own death than the man who would murder him. At 7 p.m, at the Rising Sun pub in King's Cross, Gerrit said that Jan had sunk at least 8 pints of beer. As a big man with a cast-iron liver who could hold his drink, he wasn't stumbling drunk, just loud and mouthy, having engaged in yet another pointless argument with the barman until last orders. Around midnight, back at the Osborne Hotel, Jan was noisy, Gerrit said. He started singing. Jan said he wanted some cigarettes and asked me to go with him as he didn't know the way. The nearest place selling ciggies was White's Coffee Store at 137 to 139 Euston Road, which is owned by Fred White. As a fast food store with space for a few standing customers, as Fred and Charles, the manager, cooked and served, perched at the bar were 7 customers. Jan and Gerrit, Gerardus Nedepol of Antwerp, a 4th unidentified Dutch seaman, US Army Private Jeremiah Sullivan, a black GI named Private Herman Carter Robinson, and his paid-for date for the night, a white prostitute called Alice Emily Shepherd. The mood was fine. Until Jan, who'd become pissed off that the stall didn't sell the brand of cigarettes that he wanted, got all pissy. As Gerrit recalled, I was standing back as I was fed up with him grumbling. And as this minor inconvenience had truly knocked him, Fred said he was mad drunk and looking for trouble. At 12:15 a.m, in what Gerrit recalled as for no reason, having never seen each other before, Gerrit barked at Herman. You black bastard. You wouldn't be with a white girl in the States. I've been over there, and I know what they would do to you, you Mexican bastard. As Gerrit tried to quieten him. Being wary of this brute's aggression, as Jan spat, you Mexican nigger, Herman rightfully said, hey, watch that stuff, meaning his bad language. But as Jan's racist blood boiled even hotter, having pushed the black GI to goad him to fight, as Gerrit held Jan back, Alice and Herman saw their chance to leave and took it. Herman and Alice were walking away, heading back to the Liberty Club, a hostel for black servicemen. And as far as they were concerned, the argument was over. They had only made it 25 feet west. But as they passed the coffin makers and the front entrance of the Elizabeth Garrett Anderson Hospital, having broken free, Jan screamed, I'll break your bloody neck! As he dived right on top of Herman. The fuming Dutchman repeatedly punched Herman in the face and slammed his head into the pavement. As the two men tumbled into the road, risking being run over as cars swerved to avoid them. And although Fred had tried to split them up, again Jan broke free and grabbed Herman by the throat, screaming, "I'll kill you, you black bastard. I'll fucking kill you." As all racists are thick as pig shit. As the two scuffled and Alice screamed, Fred later stated, "I parted them again. The coloured soldier went away with the woman, and I stood with the Dutchman until they were out of sight. All the time they were going up the road, he was shouting, 'I'll kill you, you black bastard.' He was raving mad." With the Liberty Club so close, having said goodbye to Alice, Herman was safely behind a locked door within minutes. So by the time that Gerrit and Fred had released the seething sailor, he'd vanished for good. And yet, barely seconds later, Jan would be dead. His killer was a total stranger to him, who was known as the Creeper. The Creeper was an enigma, and what little we know about him is sketchy at best. Born in 1907, supposedly in Lagos, Nigeria, in West Africa. Unremarkably, the Creeper's real name was Philip Berry. Being short and stockily built, in a scruffy brown suit and a trilby hat, burdened by a moon-shaped face, the thin black moustache on his top lip looked like a slug had humped his nose. And with his glasses so thick, they looked as wide as cracked saucers. Although an odd little man, always wearing crepe-soled brothel creepers on his feet, he walked with a skulking gait, as if he was always up to something bad. His nickname amongst the prostitutes was Jesus. As apparently, mid-coitus, he was prone to quoting scripture from the Bible. And although strange, it wasn't the only thing about Philip Berry which was. For 20 years, Berry had been a boilerman stoking the fires which fueled the engines of cargo ships, like the SS Honamu. It was a dark and grueling job, for little pay. But all that changed on the 5th of July 1942, when the 7,000-ton beast was torpedoed by a German U-boat and sunk in the Bering Sea off Finland. Of the 41 crew, 13 died, and although 28 survived, after 2 weeks adrift in a frozen lifeboat, with no food, no fire, and no shelter, many were badly injured, with the fingers of Berry's left hand falling off owing to frostbite. Rescued by a British crew, Berry moved to London, got a job as a boilerman in the bowels of the War Office in Whitehall. And although he lived in cheap lodgings across the city, he rarely slept there. Instead, he chose to snooze outside in the air, on a chair by a fire in a club, as if he was back on board his ship, or often spending his nights prowling the street. The Creeper had a reputation as a weirdo. By day he walked. By night he stalked. As his soft shoes silently creaked along the red light districts of Soho, Paddington and King's Cross, looking for whatever love he could find, for at most a pound a time. In October 1942, at a pub in Soho, he met 31-year-old Mary Miller of Scotland, a dance hostess and prostitute. And although he said he loved her, She'd state, "We met from time to time, by appointment." As a widow from an unhappy marriage, with three children, all of whom were dead, Mary's life was hard, and made harder as her dead husband had no savings or pension, so she had no choice but to sell sex. In January 1943, Berry moved in with Mary. Only this wasn't a relationship which was built on love, but fear. As being a nasty piece of shit, her face was often bruised, her body was often battered, as many times he would strangle her. Being possessive and jealous of her having sex with other men, which was odd, given that he lived off her earnings as a prostitute. As an abusive bully who regularly carried one of two revolvers in his pockets. At least twice that we know of, the police were called to their flat, as he had threatened to kill her. In August 1943, as Mary sat on the windowsill, cleaning the windows of her flat on Cambridge Road in Kilburn, "He caught hold of my legs," Mary said, "and tried to push me backwards out of the window. I kicked him so hard, he let go. But as he pushed me, he shouted, 'You look fine on the other side.'" Meaning dead. On Saturday, the 19th of February, 1944, in her second floor flat at 20 Torriano Avenue in Kentish Town, having grabbed Mary by the throat and pinned her to the bed, before he could hurt her further, her lodger and her client wrenched him free, and insisting he leave, she tossed his suitcase out of the front door. That day, Mary complained to the police, but they did nothing, as being a prostitute, it was said she brought it on herself. Her life was worth nothing. And although Philip Berry was a criminal who was known to the police as the Creeper, they would do nothing to protect her until he turned to murder. On Tuesday, the 22nd of February, 1944, 2 days later, Berry returned. Entering what he saw as his flat, which he'd been booted out of, to collect his suitcase, which wasn't there, only to find his woman in bed with another man, a cowardly client who would flee in terror with his trousers round his ankles. 10-year-old Joseph Yules, a neighbour, said that he heard a man knocking a woman about in that house. As he rained down fists upon Mary's screaming and steadily swelling face, neighbours said they heard the rear window open. Why is uncertain. Maybe she was trying to call for help, or maybe it was her only means of escape. But with 2 9-year-old twins, the Richardson boys, clearly stating, "The black man pushed Mrs. Miller out of the window. He pushed her in the small of her back." With the entire street alerted to her panic screams, "I saw her hanging out of the window. She fell downwards and screamed all the time. Falling 20 feet onto the hard concrete of the basement steps below, she landed head first." With the police and an ambulance arriving just a few minutes later, Dr. Sidney Tibbles stated she was found in a crumpled heap, wearing just her pajamas. Bleeding from a severe skull fracture and coughing up blood, as she drifted in and out of consciousness, she was rushed to St. Mary's Hospital in Islington. Listed as critical, with her left eye ruptured and protruding, blood in her spinal fluid, and her brain swollen. Mary fell into a coma, and although she was described as a death's door, miraculously she survived. Callously describing her as not my wife, just a girl. In several statements Berry made to Police Inspector McDonald, all of which were inconsistent, on the 18th of May 1944, he was tried at the Old Bailey. Discharged from hospital a day later, Mary was too sick to give evidence, and owing to her head injury, she couldn't recall what had happened that day. And although it should have been a clear case of attempted murder, with much of the evidence based on what the witnesses had seen, it wasn't to be. With the defense describing Mary
as a woman who preyed on colored men when they have money to spend,
and even the judge sympathizing with him by stating
it was a great pity he had anything to do with her,
bafflingly finding no intent to his crime, on the 22nd of May, the charge was reduced from attempted murder to grievous bodily harm, and Philip Berry was sentenced to just 9 months. Sent to Brixton Prison, he served just 6 and was out by November. Mary was left a broken woman who walked with a limp, suffered from epilepsy, sickness, headaches and dizziness, and barely able to work legally, let alone illegally. She struggled to get by on benefits. Berry was a violent man who was selfish and sinister. And although she still bore the physical scars and the emotional wounds he had inflicted upon her, on Boxing Day, at a Chinese cafe in New Compton Street in Soho, he stalked her for the third time that month and pestered this weak woman for money. "We argued," Mary said, and suffering a fainting spell. "As I fell against him, I struck my head on a hard object under his coat. A 45 caliber revolver. As an evil, unrepentant beast, although she was hardly half the woman she once was, unable to give him a single penny, he spat,
'I failed the first time, but I won't fail a second time.'
That day, on New Compton Street, Philip Berry tried to shoot Mary Miller dead. But thankfully, having been ushered to safety by a friend, that's the last time I saw him. Mary Miller would survive her violent relationship with Philip Berry. And although they had never met, death was looming for a Dutch sailor called Jan. Sunday the 14th of January 1945. After a grueling shift, shoveling coal into the boilers in the fiery bowels of the War Office, even though he lived in a small lodging at 8 Mornington Crescent in Camden, Berry had a quick snooze at the Coloured Colonial Social Club at 5 Gerrard Street, and then he hit the dark-lit streets. His eyes wide, his fingers gnarled, and his shoes shuffling stealthily, as in his pocket lay a 45 caliber revolver. And although the ladies of the night all knew him, they wisely crossed the street to avoid the creeper. At 12:15 a.m, outside of White's coffee stall on Euston Road, the hulking lump of Jan hurled Herman's stick-thin frame to the ground, punching, kicking, and slamming his head into the road as cars swerved. scuffling, as Alice screamed. Fred pulled the two men apart. As aided by Garrett, he held back the red-faced, seething moron, who frothed with rabid racism, spitting,
"I'll kill you, you black bastard. I'll fucking kill you."
As Alice, the sex worker, led Herman, the black GI, round the corner until he was out of sight. The fight was over. Herman was gone, and Jan's temper was cooling. Herman later said,
"The woman walked with me as far as Upper Woburn Place, where she said goodnight, and I went into the Liberty Club."
It was his first day in London. He didn't know anyone at the coffee stall. Not Fred, not Alice, and especially not Jan. And like most people, he saw nothing and he heard nothing. But out of the darkness, the creeper crept like the wind. Fred said,
"The next thing I recall is that a small coloured man ran into me, knocking me off my balance, saying, 'Get out of my way.'"
By then, being stood in front of a coffin maker's, as he venomously glared into the inky blackness amongst the dim out, into where Herman had vanished to, the last thing that Jan supposedly heard wasn't Barry's brothel creepers, but him shouting,
"You couldn't kill me, buddy."
Barry didn't know him. They'd never met. And what he saw of the incident before is uncertain. From his right pocket, Barry pulled the revolver. And although the looming shadow of the giant pasty racist swamped the little black dot, although easily a foot taller and twice his weight, the Dutch seaman was no match for four hard, fast slugs from a .45. And fired from just 2 feet away, Jan fell like a sack of shit. The first bullet ripped open his right wrist as he covered his eyes. The second burrowed deep into his chest, which severed his left lung, his aorta, and ricocheted off his spine. The third smashed his left shoulder, and shattering into pieces, they exited his body like shotgun pellets. And the fourth dislocated his left elbow. Slumping to the ground, Jan could do nothing but dribble and bleed. His pale face on the frosty floor, as blood and various fluids oozed from every orifice, whether new wounds or old holes. Having been shot directly outside of the Elizabeth Garrett Anderson Hospital on Euston Road, the big bearded brute was carried inside and examined by Dr. Dixon. But with his beer-filled chest swimming in blood, and what was supposedly his heart bleeding out, Jan Bevien was pronounced dead on arrival. As you might expect, the investigation was short. Very short. 8 people at the coffee stall described him as a small black man with a slug-like tash, thick-lensed glasses, a brown trilby hat, a dirty suit, and a deformed left hand. And with Alice Shepherd, Herman's brief date and a King's Cross sex worker, stating, "I heard the shots. He ran past me by the fire station. I knew this man as Jesus." Inspector John Black easily identified the suspect as the Creeper. At 12:40 a.m, Barry returned to the Coloured Colonial Social Club to sleep by the fire. And just 11 hours after the shooting, Barry was arrested in room 0047 of the War Office, shoveling coal into a boiler. When questioned, Barry said,
"I don't wish to make a statement, I'm in enough trouble.
So why he did it remains a mystery.
Tried at the Old Bailey on the 12th of March 1945 before Mr. Justice McNaughton, pleading guilty to willful murder. After a 3-day trial, the jury retired for just 1 hour before returning with a guilty verdict. Donning his black cap, Justice McNaughton decreed that the right sentence was a death sentence. And although manslaughter was not considered, as there was no hint of provocation, later commuted to life in prison. Once again, Philip Berry would serve a pitiful sentence and was released after just 10 years. Oddly, in November 1945, just 8 months after his trial, having been reduced to theft, having stolen a pendant and a book of clothing coupons from a neighbour on Torriano Avenue, and deceit owing to the horrific injuries inflicted by her ex-boyfriend Philip Berry, Mary Miller was tried at the Old Bailey. As a widow, Mary had struggled to scrape by, later learning that her husband wasn't dead, but he had in fact abandoned her. With him also having bigamously married her, Mary was charged with falsely declaring the army pension of a serving soldier, and she was sentenced to 6 months in Holloway Prison. Hearing the news, owing to her weakened heart, she collapsed. Carried to her cell by two warders, an uncompassionate judge declared,
"You are obviously in need of medical attention, and you will get the best of that in a place of detention."
33-year-old Mary Miller, who still had the scars of the attack on her broken skull, would serve more time in prison for bigamy than Berry did for her attempted murder.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
That was a race to get that done. Welcome to Extra Mile. Unscripted, this unscripted, unedited bit. There we go. It's a bit of a race against that one to get that recorded. The rains are coming in, and in the back, I'm going to take your little hat off. Sorry. In the background was a duck, one of those rapey little ducks that are out there, the mallards, and mouthy little bastard was meh 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 He did that for 10 minutes solid. And I can hear him. He's down on my left. He's probably about 300 feet away. And I can hear him getting nearer and nearer. And I was thinking, oh, you little bastard. You little bastard. Stay over there. Don't want you turning up and mouthing off in front. Ruining the Atmos. So there we go. There we go, folks. So I hope you enjoyed that one. That was another one that I found in the archives. Didn't know that much about it. To be honest, the file itself wasn't that interesting. I found out about the Creeper whilst researching the Soho Strangler, if I remember correctly. I think I was about right. I think I was researching the final murder of the Camden Ripper because where the final lady was murdered, it's literally not too far away. It's literally not too far away. So I stumbled across this one, and then in the papers, they were referring to him as the Creeper, and I thought to myself, "Yeah, I'm definitely going to do that case at some point." And I pulled the file out of the archives, and it was all right. It was just I was expecting a lot more from the Creeper, but when I started researching the attack on Mary Miller, that really kind of made it for me. That really made it quite exciting. So I'd love to know more about the Creeper. Unfortunately, there's not much out there. And given the fact that he was an American, he probably went back to America. And given the fact that his name is potentially Philip Berry, is the name he goes under. And, you know, it's not exactly a unique name. Not like Jan Bernardus, whatever his bloody name was. Hugen Fliegen, yeah, Schmugen, Schmugen, whatever it is. So, Philip Berry will be hard to track down. I mean, even though physically he's easy to track down, he'll be hard to track down. But there we go. There we go. What's going on in the world? I don't think I'm going to make a cup of tea because it's... What time is it? 11:20. I wrote this one. Really, this was really... I really enjoyed writing this one, so it was really easy to write. Therefore, I'm ahead of the game. Therefore, I'll go to the other coffee shop today and I'll sit and I'll have my decaf soy latte, and then I'll have a Diet Coke, and then I'll regret it because I'm an old man now. I can't have Diet Coke because it makes me wee a lot. It makes me wee really fast. So it's a bladder irritant, and I shouldn't really have it, but I do like a Diet Coke. I might have to suck it up and not suck it up. I might have to suck it up and have a caffeine free Diet Coke, which tastes like shit. Anyway, what else is going on? I removed the bandages off my back yesterday, having blistered. I got burn blisters up my back. Ooh, they were horrible. They were big, big old burn blisters. So I took it off yesterday. The nurses said it should, you know, after 10 days it should be fine. I'd had three lots of bandages put on, courtesy of the NHS, all for free. Thank you very much, NHS. Oh, it's nice having an NHS, isn't it? All free. You don't have to pay for anything. You pay your taxes and it's all done for you, and you walk in when you need to. Oh, what a great way to live. Sorry, Americans. very nice, great service. Walked in really, I had the same lady the second and third time. She was very good, very helpful. And she looked at it and she said, yeah, that's fine. Give it another 10 days. And I was like, it's starting to itch. And she was like, oh, that's good. Itching means it's drying out, but it also means that it's starting to heal. So I checked it the other day and it felt really good, which is very good. What's going on else? Today is payday. Today I get paid my money from Acast, which I consider payday, which is good. I'm going to buy myself some new boots because I need some new boots. I'm going to need a new waterproof jacket because that's bust again. And also this is how boring I am. The highlight of my day. Do you know what the highlight of my payday is? My money comes in. Sorry, I got a mate who's never worked in his life, and he always refers to my money, his benefits, as my money. It's just he's not sick. He's just really fucking lazy. He doesn't want to work. He's always got excuses. So he always goes, oh, I'll come out when I get my money. So I always make reference to my money. This is my money because I fucking work for it. When my money comes in, I always put a big chunk of it in my ISA. I've always done that for years. I always have loads of savings because I'm, you know, when you've been poor, you never want to be poor. So you always stockpiling money. And that's the first thing I do. And that's what I'm waiting for, is my money to come in. And then I can put it in my ISA. which is very exciting. That literally is what I do. I put in money into my ISA, and then I go, oh, let's top it up to that amount, and then I go, oh, maybe a bit more. That's the highlight of my day. Oh, great. What else is going on? It was my niece's birthday the other day. That's very exciting. Because two of my nephews remembered, and two nephews forgot, and my niece forgot, and because it's her birthday just gone, I sent her the cheapest card I could find. It was 10p. It said on the front, favourite nephew. Inside, I wrote, well, you didn't bother to wish me a happy birthday. Not even a card. Happy birthday, Uncle Donkey, as I'm known. Not even that. So I sent her a really shit card with, because you couldn't be asked to say happy birthday to me. And inside, I put a coin, and it was a 25 French centime coin, which for her will be of no use at all. And it was funny. And then I put a second class stamp on it, which meant it would arrive late. It's very funny. I got a message from her the next day going, Uncle Donkey, thank you very much for my card and my coin, inverted commas. Sorry I didn't say happy birthday to you. Which is important. I think you should do that. I think if people forget your birthday and their family, you should make it clear to them. You know, I never forget their birthdays. I never forget anniversaries. Anyone who has an anniversary, I always remember that because it's in my phone, and I always make sure I send them a card. Or even if I do forget, I always message them and say happy birthday. I'm going to thank Patreon supporters. See, I'm remembering to do things. Why? Because I write stuff down. Good boy. Thank you to Patreon supporters, Victoria Blewett, Andrea, a.k.a. WPC Stubbs, and Grand Mimi. So thank you, Victoria Blewett. Thank you, Andrea, a.k.a. WPC Stubbs and Grand Mimi. I wonder if you are a real WPC or whether you're just using that to try and get close to Police Constable Arsenal Guinness or a Metropolitan Plot. I wonder if you know Police Constable Arsenal Guinness. There we go. That could be quite exciting. Just to say, I hope everyone, if you are a Patreon subscriber, don't forget everyone who's a Patreon subscriber gets access to Bad Nanometers, which goes out every Thursday. I add in stuff that's just, I read out in full things that would kind of appear in the research that may be interesting to you. I find them interesting. So it's kind of, it gives you a, rather than a half an hour episode where we're kind of adding little details, this is like, if it's a full 5-page statement, we will read the full, well, not we, I will read it. You don't read it because you can't see it, but I can see it. Therefore, I read it. And sometimes badly, but therefore I read it. And it, you know, it's just interesting stuff. So if you like Murder Mile and you like all the extra research and stuff like that, join in. There's loads of extra stuff. Was it Mikey the other day very kindly said that the Patreon content is exceptional. I don't remember if you used the word exceptional. I'm going to use the word exceptional. You didn't use the word great or good, but it was a good word. It was a big word. I remember that, but I can't remember what the word was. I think it could have been incredible. It could have been magnificent. Let's say magnificently incredible. There we go. So let's do some quiz questions, and then we'll dive into some extra stuff. It's not Walk With Me. What am I doing? My brain is gone. This is Extra Mile. I've got too many things happening. My brain is just fried. Right. 10 questions. Don't forget, I haven't edited the episode yet, so I might balls them up. So let's do this. Question number one. London was in a blackout, but what... London wasn't in a blackout at the time of the murder, but what was it in? Question number two, what hotel was Gerrit staying at? Question number three, what jobs did Jan and Gerrit do? Ooh, no, I need a wee now. I haven't even had a Diet Coke. Question number four, what pub did they go to first? Question number five, how many pints do we know that Jan drank? Question number six, what did Alice and Herman have at the coffee stall? Question number seven, Herman was staying at what hotel/club? Question number eight, in what city was Philip Berry born? Question number nine, his nickname amongst the prostitutes was what? And question number 10, why? I.e., why to question number nine? Not why, that's a bigger question, that's a huge question. So let's dive into some extra stuff. This location doesn't exist anymore. It got demolished many years ago. It was owned by Frederick White of Seven Sisters Road. It was on the corner of Euston Road. And just up from here is an airline called Eva Air. Oh, what a wonderful airline that must be. If all the air stewardesses and the pilots look like Eva. I travel everywhere. So the victim, inverted commas victim, because I think we can agree he's not, even though he was killed, I wouldn't really call him a victim. I'd call him a twat. His name was Jan Bernardus Perveen. He was a Dutch seaman, heavily built, 6'2" tall. At that time, he was living in a seaman's home, in the East End. We don't quite know where. Apparently they were both on shore leave, and he had a tendency to get very drunk and very violent. Quite racist, born on the 26th of August 1917 in Rotterdam. The woman, Alice Emily Shepherd of 13 Affleck Street, N1, so that's kind of just North London slightly, I think that is King's Cross, I think Affleck Street is. Her street name was Callie. She was a housewife. At the time of all this, her husband was in the Pioneer Corps in Belgium. The man, Herman Carter Robinson, private first class, he was in the quartermaster service of the US forces, and they currently at that point were based in Taunton, so that's Somerset. He was staying at the Liberty Club, which, as mentioned, was a club specifically for black servicemen. What else have we got? The fight. Let's dive into some details about that. What do I want to tell you about this? I kind of simplified it slightly because it was slightly annoying. It was kind of Jan punched Philip in the face as he turned around, knocked him into the road into the roadway. Jan dived on top of him. They were both fighting. Jan was banging Philip's head on the ground. It's really weird. There's so much anger here, and he doesn't even know him. But I think it is just he saw a black man with a white woman, and he got angry because he's a massive racist. Sometimes that's all it takes with people who don't have a lot of brains and also like to blame other people for the failings in their life. Let's be honest, that's the problem with most things in life, isn't it? That people blame other people for things because their life is shit and therefore they have to find a fault, and instead of turning to themselves and going, I'm the cocksucker here, I'm the shitbag, I fucked up my life, they go, no, it's that person because of their skin colour or because they're from a certain country, or, you know, utter wankers out there, really are some shitbags in the world. People who need to wake the fuck up, look in the mirror and go, oh, it's me, I'm the problem with my life, not everyone else. Utter wankheads. Oh, anyway, Jan knocked Philip to the ground, as mentioned. Mr. White, so that's Fred, intervened and separated them both. It's Fred's statements are really dubious, and we'll get into that in a bit. I'm not saying that Fred is a liar. I'm just saying that when the police turned up, he might have heightened things a little bit to make him sound more heroic. Jan grabbed Philip by the throat, and they were fighting in the road. Fred said, when I went back to the stall, the Dutchman ran up to the road after the coloured soldier and knocked him down again. That was about 25 yards west. I heard the girl screaming, and the others at my stall said he had got him on the ground. I left the stall again and parted them. The coloured soldier went away with the woman, and I stood with the Dutchman until they were out of sight. All the time they were going up the road, the Dutchman was shouting, I'll kill you, black bastard, I'll kill you. He said he held the Dutchman against the wall, describing the Dutchman as raving mad. We'll get back to that in a second. Mary Miller, whose story we learned about in here. So she, at the time she met Philip Berry, she was 31, 33 when she finally got rid of that piece of shit. She was a dance hostess. Her real name was Mary Baird Reed. She was born in Scotland on the 4th of March 1913. So even though the newspaper said she was 23 years old, she wasn't, she was 33. Well done, newspapers. All you've got to do is do simple maths. She was married in 1935 to a William Hanks. She lived with him until war broke out, and he was serving overseas. They had three children, but all of them died prematurely. Unhappy marriage. She was separated / possibly divorced from him, and payments were coming in from him, but then they kind of stopped in around 1941. And she'd been told that her husband had been killed in action, although she had no proof of this. But let's not forget, it's wartime. So there's a lot of people disappearing, a lot of people being killed, a lot of bodies not being able to be proved, people going missing. And if you're a prisoner of war, you can still be reported missing or dead, even though no one knows where you are. I'm just going back on this. So that was her original husband, and then she met a man called Robert Miller, who was a corporal. That was around 1941. Apparently they married at Greenwich Town Hall, and he was a serving sergeant in the Royal Electrical Mechanical Engineers. So that's where we kind of get the idea at the end that she is, she's married, but she's bigamous married, because she was told that her former husband was dead, but apparently he wasn't dead. She had some criminal convictions, but nothing major. 1929 in Edinburgh, Mary B. Reed was convicted of theft and charge. She stole 10 shillings. March 1940 in Aldershot. So this is clearly when she's with... she's clearly there to be near the barracks. So that must be where her husband was. She was fined £2 for receiving 4.5 pounds of beef. November 1944 in Clerkenwell, she was fined for receiving bad linen. 7 sheets and 4 pillowcases valued at £4. And 5th of February 1945 in Southampton, she did 1 month's hard labour for trespassing on government land. It doesn't really say much about it there at the moment. In the report, it said she had no convictions for soliciting or prostitution, even though the police file states there is no doubt this woman is just a common prostitute. She has no respect for her at all. It's just, they really don't. Philip, he had an alibi that night, but it's not a very good alibi. So I didn't put that in because it kind of throws it off. But Joseph Bracco and Daniel John, two black men of Harrington Square. Don't forget, this is the 1940s. So, you know, if it's a black man, they go, the black man, because it's exciting. Oh, a black man. Wow. God. For some people, it could be the first kind of black person they see. So therefore, that's kind of the thing where they go, ooh, wow. They were at the Coloured Colonial Social Club at 5 Gerrard Street. Gerrard Street is now what we would regard as Chinatown, just south of Soho. They were there all night on the 14th, so that's a Sunday, playing billiards. They said roughly around midnight, Berry walked in and wanted to join the game. He was still in the club at 4:30 in the morning the following morning when he left. Edward Thomas, the night porter at the club, said he admitted Berry at 11:55 p.m. and Berry remained there until the tubes opened in the morning. So that was about 6 a.m. That apparently was his alibi, and there were only three people in the club to prove it. Although, see, if he admitted him at 11:55 p.m, that would mean he wasn't there when the murder happened. Betty Williams, assistant at the club, said he arrived between 12:30 and 12:40 a.m, 20 minutes after the shooting. She identified him as the man who entered the club at 12:40 a.m. Mr. Mark looked into the billiard room at about 6 a.m. and found a small coloured man known as Jesus asleep on the chairs in front of the fire. We woke him, told him to go. He did. He'd known him for about 9 months. We knew him quite well. And the distance from where the shooting happened to 5 Gerrard Street is roughly around 25 minutes if you walked it. So it's all doable. So it makes sense that he would have done the shooting, then he would have ran down to a place that he knows. So that all fits together. Alice Shepherd and Herman, their statements. Alice said, I turned towards St Pancras Church, so that's on the opposite side of the road. If you've ever been to Euston Station, you've come out of Euston Station, if you look left, you will see the fire station that's still there. And then just down from that is the Elizabeth Anderson Hospital. That's next door to that. And then immediately next door to that would have been the cabinet, the coffin makers and the coffee shops. So that's right there. And immediately opposite that is St Pancras Church. She said, I then turned towards St Pancras Church. I saw a civilian running towards Evershalt Street. He was coming from the direction of the coffee stall. So this is after the shooting. But on the opposite side of the road, he passed very close to me on the corner of Evershalt and Euston Road. As the lights were on, I got a very good view of him. He was short and dressed in a dark overcoat and a trilby hat down in front. I knew this man as Jesus, as he'd pestered me on several occasions. And he was known to women I know who told me his name. She said she heard the shots as she got to the corner of Upper Woburn Place and Euston Road, having just said goodbye to Herman. And Jesus ran past her by the fire station. He was running very fast. Herman said, the woman walked with me as far as the corner of Upper Woburn Place where she said goodnight. That's nice of her. She's walked him home. Oh, fresh, that's lovely. And then I went to the Liberty Club. I did not hear any shots fired. This is important. During the time I was at the coffee stall, I did not see any coloured male civilians. So if Philip Berry said that he was there, he would have recognised him. But he said everyone there was white. And nobody intervened to take my side. So, Fred White, when you say that you intervened, apparently they say that you didn't. This was his first trip to London. No one knew him, and he was due back on camp in Taunton the next day. Little bit about the murder in here. Let's dive into some of the stuff that Fred said. Because don't forget, Philip didn't give a statement. Even though he gave a few statements to his prior conviction for Mary Miller's attempted murder, i.e. GBH, he didn't with this one. It's your right. You can make the decision not to do that. So he gave nothing. Fred said, the next thing I remember is that a small coloured man, a civilian, ran into me and gave me a push, which knocked me off my balance, saying, get out of my way. When the small Negro pushed me, I stumbled backwards to the edge of the pavement. The small Negro was standing about 2 feet on my right, just off the curb. The Dutchman was still standing by the wall of 151 Euston Road. That is that's where the coffin makers was. The gun, 45 caliber revolver, not found. No idea where it is, and there were no, because it was a revolver. No empty shell casings were found at the scene. Although Mary Miller confirmed that Berry was in possession of a similar firearm. The shooting, this is Fred again, he said, I saw a small Negro draw a revolver from his right pocket. This, he pointed at the Dutchman and fired 4 shots. As the Negro fired 4 shots, Berry apparently shouted, you couldn't kill me, buddy. It's interesting. I couldn't find anyone else who can verify that source. Fred said the Dutchman fell downwards to the ground. Jan staggered backwards against the wall and fell. Gerrit ran, as did the others. Now, this is the bit I like about it. I didn't put this in the episode, but this is what Fred said. When the Negro was firing, I lifted my right foot with the intention of trying to kick the revolver out of his hand. He then fired at me, and the flame, i.e. the muzzle, appeared to pass in front of my body. The small Negro was standing underneath the lamp, and I could see him perfectly. He does that a couple of times. I mean, it could be true. It could be true that he dived on them. He broke them up and he was almost shot at, but he could just be bullshit. So let's do the quiz questions and then I will go and urinate. Oh, exciting. And then I'll go to the coffee shop and start doing all burpees, the first edit on this. So there we go. Question number one. London wasn't... That's question number one. Question number one. London wasn't in a blackout, but what was it in? It was in a dim out. Question number two, what hotel was Geralt staying at? It was the Osborne Hotel. Question number three, what jobs did Jan and Geralt do? They were merchant seamen. Question number four, what pub did they go to first? It was the Rising Sun, which is still there today, just down from there, and is now called the Rocket. Question number five, how many pints do we know that Jan had drank? At least 8 pints of beer. Legend. Question number six, what did Alice and Herman have at the coffee stall? They had tea and cake. Of course they did, because they're civilised, they're decent people. Question number seven, ooh, little fart there. Question number seven, Herman was staying at what hotel and club? It was the Liberty Club. Oh no, this isn't going to become the episode where people go, oh, duh, like the bit where you fart. Oh no, please don't let it become the fart episode. It is, isn't it? All my hard work and it's going to become the, the fart was funny. What about the rest of the episode? Yeah, the fart was funny. Oh no. Question number eight. In what city was Philip Berry born? Supposedly Lagos, but he also lived in Freetown in Sierra Leone. Question number nine, his nickname amongst prostitutes was what? Jesus. And question number 10, why? It was said that he quoted scripture while having sex. Well, there we go. There we go. It takes all sorts, doesn't it? Takes all sorts. So that's me done, folks. Hope you enjoyed that. That was episode, what was that? 248. There you go, 248 episodes. Almost entirely original episodes full of details that you can't get anywhere else. There you go. I'm only saying that because I was talking to a podcaster, a very well-known podcaster this week, and their episode took them 3 hours to do. 3 hours. That's 3 hours research and writing and recording. Oh, why do that? Why not put in the effort for the audience? Why not put in the effort? And this is a really, really successful podcast. And they just didn't want to do it. Couldn't be asked. And I even said, are you happy with the episode? And they went, nah, shit. But it's fine. I can't do that. I did say to them, I'm on day six of research in this case now. Day six. Anyway, I'm going to continue doing what I want to do, which is researching really hard and making these the best episodes I can and making them really nice for you. Because I don't think I could do that. I don't think I could do a shit piece together, do it in one evening and bang it out kind of shite. I can't do that. I'm sorry, I can't do it. Anyway, that's me done. I'm going to go to the coffee shop and see if I've been paid for my money. Where's my money? So anyway, I'll catch you all soon, folks. Thank you for supporting the show. It's very much appreciated. Have yourself a good one. Stay safe and be good. Lots of love.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.